The Burgerkrieg Productions 15 Minutes of Fame podcast finishes season 3 with drummer Dougie Tangent of the Putts. Here's their latest song, I Hope You Get Coal, from the Coffin Curse Records Shitters Full Holiday Compilation to benefit Toys for Tots.
You get gold. I hope you get gold. I hope you get gold. Oh, I hope you get gold. You love to make all the other kids sad. Spent all year being nothing but bad. King of the sea and you never played fair. You asked me and time you learned to share. Oh yeah. You're just an asshole and you're...
Well, you might say, this is crazy, Doug. What the fuck are you thinking? I was probably like 39 or so, 39 at the time. And, you know, you're old enough to know better. Why are you doing this? Well, it was a chance for us to direct support Richie Ramone.
Oh, okay.
And the show was sold out. And it was absolutely packed, assholes to elbows. And Richie used, he played on my drum set and he signed ahead. He signed a drum head. He signed a poster. We sold a buttload of merch. It was, by all accounts, the juicy show we just talked about. And it was absolutely worth every bit of that energy and compromise that I had to put into making that happen. It was absolutely worth it. And now we're playing with him again. He keeps asking for us.
That's awesome.
He knows who we, he knows who we are. We're playing with him again in April in Indianapolis, but this time on a Saturday night, so you know it's going to be lit.
Yeah.
And so that's an example right there. It was like, okay, how could I say no to that? I got to figure out how to make that happen.
Sure.
You know, like, you know, I got to make that happen. It was sold out. It was like, and we absolutely just, the crowd just ate us up. It was great. They loved it. So it was like, we had to play that one. That was like us in our element. I couldn't, I would feel so bad if I was the reason why we didn't play that show. You know,
did he,
so there you go.
Did he put his foot through your bass kick by any chance?
No, why?
So when I saw him at Ralph's Rock Diner in Mass, he definitely put his foot through the bass kick and they had to come out mid set and basically replace it. Like I know that he's like a fucking animal and he's super nice. I met him after the show. He signed my promo copy of Too Tough to Die, you know, look at this. This is beautiful. You know, that type of shit. And super kind.
Yeah.
But I marveled at that, not only for obvious reasons coming, you know, playing behind the kit and singing, but then coming out and fronting the band.
Yeah.
It's just wild,
awesome.
Wild to me.
Awesome.
Yeah.
No, actually that's a great description. Some people that don't know any better that still think it's a little odd that Richie's touring, and they ask me, they're like, you know, once they hear that I've either seen or played with him, they always ask, like, oh, what's that like? You know, they're always like, scrunch their face a little bit. And, oh, what's that like? You know? Mm-hmm. And I tell him, I said, dude, don't knock it till you try it, bro. You got to go check it out. And he's still only like a $10 or $15 show on a weekday night. Why not try it? You know?
Well,
and I tell people all the time, it's wild. It's like, you go into it not even knowing what to expect. You know, you're going to hear somebody put something in my drink, but beyond that, you don't know what the fuck to expect.
I'm not Jesus. You know? Maybe a slew of other either songs from the mid 80s era or the obligatory, I'm covering a classic Ramones track. But my buddy actually put me on to the solo stuff well before I got to see him. So the Cellophane record, was, which I believe that was a tour that I saw him on.
That was a tour that the Putts played that show, okay. That Monday night show that was on the Cellophane tour.
So and that's the other thing. I think that people oftentimes will lump CJ into the same boat. I know that CJ's had a little bit more of a musical career following the Ramones versus Richie. Richie's been more of a recent thing, right? And CJ obviously had his Bad Chopper project, and then, you know, what, three or four solo records, right?
I think he's up to four total. Three of the last three of which were on FAT, but yeah. I think the first one never made it on FAT. I'm still trying to get a copy of that, actually.
So it's so obviously CJ's been a
and
little
now
bit
he's
busy.
Me first in the Gimme Gimmes.
Yes, which we saw him over the summer with Flogging Molly, and that was awesome. I mean, Me First, just as far as you know, punk rock cover bands is considered the greatest cover band in the world, right? But it's cool to see that he's still active, and I've gotten to see him a couple times. But where I was going with that is I think people make they're it's kind of like if they don't know or they haven't looked into the music, they say the same thing. Well, what is that show going to be like? And it's like, well, first of all, it's a surviving Ramon, so you should probably go and make that happen. Not only because they're surviving Ramon, but they've also been doing their own music. Nothing against Marky, but it's like, you know, that's a Ramones karaoke show, right? Which is fine.
Yeah.
But I think there's, this is just me personally, I think there's more substance, and I've never seen Marky, so I'm saying this kind of out of one side of my mouth, but I feel like there's more substance to a Richie or CJ show versus a Marky show because it's just, it's a different vibe. Here's my music, and here's some music that I you know, either penned or played while with the Ramones, you know, like, I was a part of that, so... It's cool.
And you're actually, it's good that you, it's interesting that you make that, you make a good point there. I think that that's a nod towards Richie too, in particular, because I think he needs a little, I think he deserves more respect. And if he stays more active in his current solo thing that he's doing, he'll eventually, I think people will come around, they'll warm back up to him. They'll say, okay, you know, let me go see what this guy's all about on his own. A lot of people still think he's this kind of like poor man's Ramon, but really, to be honest, out of the three, you know, still living or whatever, if you don't want to include what Clem Burke or whoever it was,
Elvis Ramon,
Elvis Ramon, out of the three, like, you know, real Ramon still living, you know, you could argue that Richie perhaps had the most contributions musically, most impact on the band musically during his respective tenure. Because, and some people might look at me going, well, what do you mean? Marky just was in the band for so long, but Marky's stints, his two stints were distinctly broken up by Richie, and his second stint in the band, when Marky came back, obviously the band had changed a lot since he left, and the band had become faster and much more dynamic and a little punkier. And there had been changes in those drums, significant change. And Johnny, for the record, was all about it. Johnny loved what Richie was doing. Johnny was like, he had already passed up on those ambitions of trying to be a top 40 artist. So he just figured, you know what? We're going to play the hardest punk we can. We're going to be the punk band. We're going to go back to our roots. I want to go harder and faster. And he had the right drummer for that in Richie. And then when it came time for Marky to come back, you know, you listen to Marky's live recordings in 1980, 81, 82 versus his live recordings in 90, 91, 92. Big, big difference.
Huge difference.
Big difference. And Richie is the reason for that. Richie, because Marky knew he couldn't go back to playing like it was 1979 again.
Yeah.
He couldn't. It wasn't.
This isn't a Richard Hell fucking record. You need to speed up, you know, like you need to play to the intensity that they have been come to have, that they work to become known as throughout that point in time. You're absolutely correct.
And Richie was pivotal in that, especially with the development of the live show, the whole the way the live show got harder and faster. Richie was a part of that. I think the Richie live shows, if you ever hear any Richie live recordings, I actually like those better than the more recent live show, like the last 5 years where the like local live era or whatever, you know, I like it better than that stuff, like basically Marky's second run. I like it better than any of that stuff. Marky, I think, was just pushing too hard. There's a fine line. Richie didn't play that fast.
No.
You know?
Well, and, you know, admittedly, you know, I'm the Richie era, specifically Too Tough to Die, is one of my, it's up there as far as Ramones records are concerned, just in general. It's just a beautiful piece of fucking music, especially coming off of the albums that came that immediately preceded that.
Especially Subterranean Jungle. They needed something.
You know, and I know the big thing with Ramones albums, and this is kind of going off of what you're talking about with, you know, Johnny kind of coming, not coming to the realization, but like we're just going to try and define, we're going to be the ultimate punk band, but also the songwriting had changed to the point where it was like, we're going to at least get one or two or three really good songs on here, and the rest are just going to be songs, right? There was
punk,
kind of that
punk songs.
Punk songs, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
If you, it's funny you mentioned like Subterranean Jungle. It's like, yeah, Psychotherapy is a great song. It's like, mm-hmm. However, I think overall that album suffers from some interesting production choices, some interesting drum tones. And it just, I don't know, when you put that compared to Too Tough to Die, you can definitely see the impact that not only Richie had in the drumming, you know, the drumming department, but just intensity of the album, you know, it's night and day, night and day.
Oh yeah. Well, I also think too, take a look at the two separate marquee eras and in regards to the studio albums, and try to think about what, because you were talking about Subterranean Jungle and the product and some bad production decisions that were made. Well, that opens up a whole conversation you could make about, from a drumming standpoint, Markey's first stint with the band recording studio albums, I mean, and his second stint with the band on the studio albums. If you look at each stint, the consistency of the drums from one album to another within each stint. So the first stint with the band, he could not seem to get a sound. I mean, like Phil, actually his drums sound great on Road to Ruin. They're probably the best of his first stint. But Phil Spector just didn't know what the fuck he was doing with that band at all, especially with Johnny's guitar and especially with Marky's drums. And the drums, I think, sound fucking terrible on End of the Century. I'd love to hear like a more remix on that, but I don't know if that's ever going to really affect it. But on Pleasant Dreams, the drums are back better again. They sound more like Road to Ruin again.
I like Pleasant Dreams as an overall record. I think it's solid. I think it's solid.
Me too. They got so close with that one. I felt like that's where they should have been going with End of the Century. I was like, okay, well, one record too late, that's fine. Better late than never. But why didn't that one blow up? End of the Century had received much more attention. It should have been Pleasant Dreams. It was, at least from a production standpoint. Yeah, I like the songs on all of them. But, and then Subterranean Jungle drums sound like hot fart and shit ass. and then enter the Richie Ramone era, where you can break down those three albums all you want, and the good and bad songs and all that. But one thing that is consistent is the drums are solid the whole way through, even on the bad songs. And so that's the one thing you can't really complain about on even the bad songs. You're not going to complain about the drums. So then when you move to Marky's return to the band, then you notice Brain Drain, Mondo Bizarro, even Acid Eaters, and Adios Amigos. Listen to the drums on all those albums. Much, much more consistent. It's like he found his voice.
See,
and it was there. And here's the reason. He was sober, bro. He was sober. Because he was not dialed in. The first handful of albums he did, I don't think he really cared how he sounded. And see, he was allowing all these other people make these decisions. Like you said, these poor decisions. And it was really affecting things. And I think if I'm in that situation, I'm going to chime up and be like, yo, these drums sound like garbage. We have to fix this. You know, we can't let this happen.
I would argue, and I've mentioned this before, I would say that as far as production is concerned, especially out of that latter era, we'll call it like the last leg of the band, right? Adios Amigos has some of the best production, I think, today.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, is that purely like Daniel Ray? Is that his doing?
Possibly.
Right? Or because also to what you're saying, I know that the band has always been involved in kind of the production, or at the very least the mixing. Like they've always worked pretty close in hand, right? They've always been part of the process. They haven't been so far removed. But to your point, you know, Marky, I think, got the fucking memo. Like, you can't, like, you're either part of this band or you're not. And it would be very interesting. I have not read his book.
It's so good. It's so good.
Does he speak to that at all? Like, upon his return to the band and sobriety. Yeah. Does he talk about that a little bit?
I don't think he breaks it down as much as I did from a musical or recording standpoint. He does speak to it a lot from a personal standpoint, like his personal relationships with people and with the band and with people close to him. And the book is more or less, I view it as not just this memoir of a punk rock drummer or this memoir of a Ramon either. I view it more as an alcoholic's journey through punk rock, like playing punk rock. Because the undertone of him being an alcoholic before, during, and after the events discussed in the book, it's a prominent undertone. It's there all the time. And you see that he has his head, like you said, he comes back to the Ramones, he finally gets the memo. Well, that's because during the Richie era, Marky was off sobering up. Mm-hmm. And that's the part of the book I found to be most interesting, even over the chapters where he's playing with Dust in the early 70s and all these gnarly fucking shows, selling out Cobo Hall in Detroit pretty regularly, which is like 40,000 people.
That's crazy.
Yeah, dude, that guy probably should have been in like Kiss or something, you know?
Right.
You know, seriously. And then he talks about Richard Hell, talks about, you know, he was like one of the very few New York bands, which I consider that to be certainly that punk, at least the existence of punk in New York, certainly preceded that of which in London. And it's a big deal for a New York band in like 77 to go tour London. And he was a part of that. And he got to experience all that gobbing and stuff over there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he talks about that. Then he talks about joining the Ramones. Then he talks about, you know, being drunk in the studio for all those first few albums. And that's when it clicked in my head. Getting back to what we were talking about. Dude, listen, he's so inconsistent on his first few albums. He is clearly letting other people make every little decision, which I understand. You're a drummer. There's only so much impact your decision is going to make. But you should still be in the room and let your voice be heard, especially if it's your own instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly you can tell he was absent when they were making those records. He was mentally absent because he's going to look back at the last record and he's going to want some kind of consistency. And Road to Ruin sounds spectacular. I mean, mm-hmm. he had a great debut. That you couldn't have a better debut than that.
I agree.
You know, and then Phil Spector, you know, okay, fine. That whole situation, it was what it was. You can't really, there's a lot of things about that you hear about that you can't control. And I get that. Everybody was kind of had their tit in the ringer on that one. But, you know, for him to be so inconsistent from album to album, then when he comes back, after the Richie era, he comes back and he's now sober and he gets the memo. And he also understands he's also kind of lucky to be in that position too. They took him back sober. They, you know, Johnny said, hey, there's always a job for you, but you got to sober up.
Mm-hmm.
And finally he did. He had to prove himself. He was sober for 5 years before he came back to the Ramones. And sure enough, he dove into it, which is really cool. He like immersed himself into it. And his drums on those last handful of albums are spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
They're fucking spectacular. It's definitely his best drumming as a Ramone in the studio, you know, on a studio album as a Ramone. But yeah, I think it is. But getting back to what you were saying, I think a lot, Daniel Ray had a lot of impact too. But I also think Daniel Ray, he understood Marky too, because if you listen to Brain Drain, which is Daniel Ray as well, and you listen to Adios Amigos, there's like five six years separating those two records, but Daniel Ray understood Marky's sound and Marky's voice, and those two records have a very, very similar drum sound. You don't want them to be the exact same, because you still want the records to have their own identities in some ways. I mean, we apply that to Putz, we apply that when we make a record, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But you know, but I think Daniel Ray understood Marky has a voice here too. Yes, we know about Joey. Yes, we know about Johnny. We know about everybody else, but Marky has a voice here too. And he paid attention to that. And that I commend that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's cool. You know,
I wonder too, you know, you mentioned obviously Road to Ruin being, you know, as we all know, that's the debut of Marky Behind the Drum Kit. And I wonder if part of what made that such a strong release versus what was to come after prior to Richie was because, well, a couple of reasons, obviously Ed Stasium first and foremost, but secondly, Tommy sure. having his hand. So you have somebody who, although wasn't necessarily born a drummer, became a drummer, and then went back to their place that they wanted to be, i.e. the studio. Tommy always, you know, as we've seen in interviews mm-hmm. and read in books and heard in documentaries, he ultimately wanted to be kind of more behind the scenes, right? He learned drums mm-hmm. just to make the band get off the ground. But then mm-hmm. now that he had kind of established what that sound was, then he was able to retreat back and work with somebody who's, you know, at that point in time yeah. in particular, it's not like Mark was a flub. He was a good drummer. It's just he was, like you said, little inconsistent, but to come out of the gate swinging, I'm wondering if pride in part that was, all right, you're working with me, I'm the original Ramones drummer.
Yeah, I think if you're wondering if Tommy had an impact on that first Marky album, absolutely. He was a co-producer, right, or something like that with Ed Stasium.
Yeah, yep.
I think something like that. I think Tommy probably his unwritten job between the two producers, his unspoken job probably was to pay extra attention to the drums, because I think the drums kind of had a hard time during Tommy's era because he was playing them great on the live. It's Alive is like one of the greatest live records ever made. I mean, his sound on that fucking record is incredible. Huge. It's my favorite. That's my favorite sound for the Ramones. To me, I think that is a band in their absolute like prime is the Ramones' It's Alive. But that's during the live shows. And if you look at those first three albums, the Tommy albums, the drums are pretty inconsistent. Mm-hmm. And between the three, you know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? They finally started to get somewhere to figure out how to record this band, especially Johnny's guitar and especially Tommy's drums. When Rocket Russia came out, because that album sounds great. But you're right. With Tommy behind the switchboard, I think he was definitely probably thinking, all right, we can't fuck this up. We finally got it right with Rocket Russia. We have to apply what we know and make sure Road to Ruin sounds just as good, if not better. This cannot sound all wacky and weird like the first two albums are so different from each other in mm-hmm. sound. We can't do that here. Rocket Rush is out there in the world, guys. We either have to match it or beat it. I mean, we know what that's like as recording musicians ourselves. You know, that's always the putz logic when we get ready to work on a new album. You know, the other albums are all out there in the world. People have already heard those. They're a thing now. They don't belong to us anymore. They belong to everybody else now. So we have to make sure we're continuously moving forward and, you know, presenting something different or better or fresh or at least equal in quality or whatever you want, however you want to, we can't allow us to step back. You know,
I agree.
You can't let somebody say their first album from 10 years ago is the best thing they've ever done. Mm-hmm. You know, I get that. If it's the one you first discovered and it's the one you're more emotionally attached to, I understand that. I was like that with Screeching Weasel, My Brain Hurts, and they made a whole bunch of albums after that. That was only like their third one. Mm-hmm. So I get it. But, it, you know, did they have better sounding albums later on? Yeah, they did. You know, it was just My Brain Hurts was the one I was attached to. It was the one I first got into. So some people, you can't mix that up either. Some people are always going to swear by this one album that, you know, and some people are like that with the worst sounding albums, you know, but it's the one they got into, like Misfits or something, you know, some of those really bad Misfits albums, right. You know, they sound terrible, but you know, they all got into those, you know, you get a soft spot for them. But does American Psycho sound better? Yes.
Oh, 100%, dude. 100% agree.
It does. It does. I'm just saying it does.
Say that and Famous Monsters. They're yeah. great fucking sonically. They're yeah. fucking solid. They're solid. Yeah. Dude.
I mean, to me, it is kind of a more or less a different band, but I have to be in, I do listen to those records when I'm in the mood for that band. Yeah. But I'm like that about the old Misfits too. They're mm-hmm. not an everyday user for me.
No, no.
I have to be in the mood for them as well. You know, like it works both ways. You know,
I would agree.
But anyway, Yeah. Anyway, sorry. I'm full of rants here.
No, no, it's okay. So let me, I want to do our quick introduction and then I can segue into, one of these other questions, mm-hmm. because we've been talking for a minute and, I want to make sure I do the traditional intro. So, it's important. It's an important piece of this, even though, you know, this will be going for roughly 15 to 20 minutes prior to us even doing an intro, but I still think it's important nonetheless. This is the Burger Crew Productions 15 Minutes of Fame podcast. I have a repeat offender, a return guest who was thankfully down to come back and talk with me ad nauseum about, all things in general. I have Dougie from the Putts, among other projects. Welcome back, Dougie. I appreciate you taking some time to chit-chat with me.
Yeah. Thanks for having me back, man. Thanks a lot. I loved the last time I was on the show, even though we talked mostly about, like, toys and G.I. Joe and Star Wars and stuff like that.
So good.
Yeah,
so good.
That was fun.
Yeah, it was fun. The first part of our conversation kind of revolved around drummers, mm-hmm. Marky, Richie, kind of the production that goes around it. And I know that you're involved with a number of different projects, but mm-hmm. I wanted your opinion on something in particular. Why do you think that drummers seem to be always the hardest piece of the band to kind of fill in? What's up with that? What is it about drummers?
Well, I think, you know, you got to find somebody. If you're trying to start a project and you're looking for a drummer, you have two problems. One is just simply finding a body, mm-hmm. because there's so few drummers out there, and getting that person, tearing that person away from his five or six other bands to spend a couple hours with you every week, you know, that's hard enough. And then your other problem is when you actually do get that person to sit down with you and jam with you, and you're trying to get something going with that person, do they understand the music you're trying to make? Like, do they understand where you're coming from? Do they, when you play them a song, do they kind of get it the way you do? And not just the way you do. There's another side of that coin too, by the way. Do they also bring something to it that is not already there? And is it the right thing? See, there's so many facets. So once you jam with somebody for the first time, and they're rigid or uptight or confused, or they're just super basic, or they're just trying to get through the song. Sure, that might be at first just to learn your song or whatever. But then after a while, you should feel less effort. You, yourself, when you're playing, and also you should see it in the drummer. There should be this kind of, things should start to feel more casual. And then eventually that leads to the drummer putting his or her stamp on the song themselves. And if the first time you notice that, whether it's you know, maybe they chime in about oh, hey, let's put a break there and I'll do a fill, or hey, let's double up on this thing on the end before we go out with the outro. The first couple times you receive that kind of feedback from the drummer, don't see it as he's totally changing your fucking song or anything. See it as he's putting his stamp on it. He or she is trying to make it their own because they're starting to get what you're doing. They're like, they get it. You know, right. That's what you need, is somebody who gets what you're trying to do. And you can feel it. You can feel it when you're jamming with them. You can feel it after. You might not feel it right away, but after maybe like one or two times, you know, if they like your tunes, if they like your music, whatever, then you start to feel it. Then it starts to, you know, you start to feel it when you're playing with them. You know, they're not as uptight, you know. I think what that does is that adds soul to the music. The song was good before, but it could be great now. Mm-hmm. You know, you just got to have that soul. It adds a little soul. A drummer that's just trying to go through the motions, just trying to get through the song, there's no soul there. He's just giving you ones and twos. That's mm-hmm. all he's giving you. You want somebody to give you soul to the song. It can really, honestly, because this is my biggest issue, is like, I gotta be a really big fan of somebody to go see them acoustically. I'm not a huge acoustic person. I mean, I like some, like, you know, classic stuff like Simon and Garfunkel or whatever.
Sure,
you know what I mean?
Sure.
But I feel like sometimes there is no soul and there's no life to some of those songs, unless, you know, that person, there are some exceptions. All right. But there has to be, this person has to blow me the fuck away. I mean, it has to be, you know, like a good example is those, for a while there, I haven't listened to the last couple Alkaline Trio albums, but I know that for a while, for most of their albums, there was always the obligatory one or two acoustic songs, and they were always usually pretty good. Mm. And I liked them, and they had a lot of soul to them, and they had a life to them. And that's hard to do without a band behind you. Mm. Now, if you are a band and you're trying to complete the circle, you're trying to find your drummer, that's important. You need a guy that's going to give it some life, because you're already 50% there as far as the life goes. You're there, you know this, you wrote this great song, you're playing guitar or bass, you're good at what you do, you sing well, you're almost home free. But it's amazing how big a difference the right or wrong person behind the kit will make when you're that close to completing this thing. You know, you need, but it really does, because you put the wrong person behind the kit, and all of a sudden your song is lacking a lot of life. I don't care how good the song is, how good of a songwriter you are, how good of a guitar player you are, whatever. You can feel it, and you can't deny it, because you'll trick yourself and think, oh, this is our guy, let's move on. He's giving me the ones and twos, that's all I need. My songs are good enough, let's move on. That's a common mistake. Mm-hmm. Then you make a recording, you play some shows, people are like kind of, yeah, that's good. But you know, they're just like talking out of one side of their mouth, you know what I mean? And then you put out this record, and it's kind of like sounds like everybody else's record. You're like, I don't know, man, fuck, what happened here? I'm not saying all of that is just one drummer's fault, but a lot of it has to do with the way you guys gel too. You also need that. It's like the drumming is only half of what you want from this guy. You need the personality too. You need the right guy.
Exactly.
Or chick. And that really will complete things. You know, one, and this would go for, I would say this about a bad guitar player or a bad bass player. You got one, you know, weak link. You're going to see it in the final product, whether it's live or whether it's on a recording or whatever. You know,
mm-hmm.
So I think you got to find the guy that, or the girl that brings the songs to life. And there is a difference. There is a life before and a life after drums. And you can see it and feel it. You're sitting on your bed at night or on the couch or something with your guitar, dicking around, writing a song. Well, that's great. I mean, obviously everything has to start there, right? We need you to do that. But then it's amazing. You know what it's like when you bring a song to a practice and no one's ever heard it before. And once they stumble through it a few times, they ask you a few dumb questions, and then you guys get it figured out. Maybe like by the next practice, that song sounds fucking great. You're mm-hmm. like, holy shit, I would have never imagined it would have. And then fast forward to like whenever you record it and you're like, holy shit. And you listen back in the studio and you're like, wow, you remember writing that on your couch, stumbling through it, and then here we are, and then it sounds like this. You know, it's because you wrote a great song, but it's also you got the right people without the right people around. You can't get it the rest of the way. You can write a great song, yes, but you cannot get it to where what I'm talking about. You know that feeling? I don't know if any of the listeners, I guess some of them might know that feeling when you hear it in the studio played back for you, and you're like, holy shit. Where did this come from? This is amazing. How did this get?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a type of thing too. I feel like, you touch on a number of different things. It's mm-hmm. the difference between having someone who's present and who's contributing mm-hmm. in their way versus showing up, going through the motions. That's
sure.
That's a huge part of it. And, you know, I'm not to quickly segue, but I wanted to briefly touch upon something. We spent a pretty good chunk of time in our first chat talking about mm-hmm. G.I. Joe. And at the time, we briefly touched upon the Snake Eyes film. That has since been mm-hmm. released. I'm guessing mm-hmm. we both went and saw it. I kind of wanted your hot take on that. I wanted to hear your opinion on the movie. What did they do well? What didn't they do well? And kind of, you know, what do you hope to see in the future when it comes to future G.I. Joe, franchise decisions and potential for films?
Well, I thought, and I hope, first of all, I think maybe we should just warn people that there's probably going to be some spoilers mentioned here. So I don't know if anybody... So if you don't want to hear any spoilers, stop the podcast now. Anyway, but that movie's been out for 6 months and it's on DVD now and it's streaming. And so fucking watch it already. You got no excuse. Well, I thought at first I thought I was going to struggle with the idea of Snake Eyes talking.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first thing on my mind because I knew he was going to talk. I mean, even before you and I talked, you and I had this conversation several months before the movie came out, but there was some things already coming out that some information about the movie already coming out and leaking out that we were kind of talking about at that time. And I knew that the actor, Henry Golding, that was playing Snake Eyes, I knew, I mean, for an actor like that, I mean, you know, he's not some big name or anything, but he's a very established actor. He's a good actor, and he's a quality, very good quality actor, and he's a definitely a leading man type material. And you would not pay him to be in a movie where there's no lines and you're asking him to wear a mask the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew that once he was slated to be in the movie, I was like, okay, this is going to be a very different, just be ready. Just, this can be a very different take on Snake Eyes. And I hope that the diehard G.I. Joe fans stay open-minded. And that went, that meant for me too. And I walked out of the theater after watching that movie. I saw it opening day when it came out, the Friday, the weekend it came out, opening day. I walked out of the theater still wondering, am I okay with having just watched Snake Eyes talk a lot and having seen his face more unmasked rather than masked? You know, he only wears a mask for like a little bit of the movie. And is this the Snake Eyes? Do I like this version of Snake Eyes? Am I, you know, and I caught myself kind of questioning things. And that's because that's just the old fan in me that's used to the old way. And as I've become more and more active in the G.I. Joe and collector community and toy collector community in general, I started to figure out, and it's not just in G.I. Joe. This goes for Transformers, Star Wars, you name it. All the collector fan bases and stuff. There are so many old 40-some-year-old dudes. They're so unbelievably stuck in their ways with the way these characters and these franchises are developed over time, especially if they're trying to be developed these days for new audiences and especially younger audiences.
Right.
And they're so stuck in their own ways. And I just don't want to be that guy. I'm not that guy. I try not to be that guy in the punk community, in the music community. I've always prided myself on being as open-minded as I can possibly be. So why would I be any different in toy collecting and the fandom involved in that? So I try to apply the same attitude in that world too. Only, holy shit, are we outnumbered. Like, oh my God. And like Master of the Universe, like all of those collector fan bases, they're all just these old 40-some-year-old white dudes, you know, that think that, you know what I mean? Like that think that they are the prime demographic and they get all pissed off when something's not exactly how they think it should be. Well, dude, I don't know what to tell you, but they're trying to get kids into this stuff. 2021 kids, not 1985 kids. So I actually look back now at a talking Snake Eyes and I'm like into it. I'm like cool with it. And I think if they used Henry Golding for like a future G.I. Joe movie that would feature Snake Eyes, then that would make sense. Now it would make sense. Like say they did like a Snake Eye or a G.I. Joe movie eventually, like they did with Avengers. Say we see like other individual character movies and then eventually they come out with like a team movie that's kind of like Avengers where you get to see them all together for the first time in one movie interacting with each other. That was a lot of fun. You know, the first Avengers movie came out, I loved it. I was like, oh, this is sweet. We're tying it all together. This is great. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't know there was going to be so many of those, but I thought it was pretty cool at the time. It would be cool if they did that with G.I. Joe. And if they ever do, I don't know if they will, but if they ever do, it would definitely need Snake Eyes to be more of a presence. And so that's why they're starting early right now with this first movie and presenting him the way they did. If they presented him differently, number one, I don't know if he could have carried a whole movie himself because he never carried the TV show himself. He was always on the side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you recall, you know,
oh yeah. Yeah. Definitely, you know? Definitely the mysterious yeah. side character that always had pretty killer outfits, especially as far as the toys were concerned, killer yeah. uniform, but again, more mysterious than anything, which yeah. is cool, which is cool. Yeah. The yin to the yang of Storm Shadow, right? Like,
sure,
that was brilliant, brilliant marketing on their end, brilliant writing when it came to obviously the comic, the television show, like brilliant the way in which they did it. But to your point, I think now it introduces a more active role, right?
Yeah.
The focal point can now be on him versus, okay, there's isn't so much pressure to be like, this is a Duke driven, right? Or this is pseudo Flint driven story, right? We're not putting that out there. I think it's, I agree. I think it's cool.
Yeah.
I love the movie. I had so much fun with it.
Oh, I had fun with it too. I've heard some mixed things about it. I've heard some people really absolutely lambaste it, and I'm just like thinking, guys, what part of this do you not understand? You went to the theater, it was fun, it was over the top a little bit with like the big snakes crawling around in the pit and stuff like that. And there was fighting, there was ninjas, there was explosions, there was fucking motorcycles, there was Baroness, hot fuck.
Oh, hell yeah.
And I'm like, what do you not like about, what is this not, how is this not at least a fun movie? Not every movie has to win an Oscar. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, some of them just have to put butts in the seats, especially during a pandemic. That's hard enough to do. And some of them just have, it's popcorn movies is what they call it. Popcorn entertainment. Just fun. You know, okay, here's a good example. Like, several years ago, you know, the Expendables movies.
Oh yeah.
Well, when the second one, see, I had never seen any of them. When the second one came out, I had not already seen the first one. So I had no idea what was going on. And I had just a minor bit of interest in them. I really honestly didn't really think much about them, but I probably would have eventually tried to see the first one. So the second one was already out in theaters. And my bass player, my buddy, he's a bass player for the Dutons, Howie, him and his wife invited me and my then girlfriend at the time to go see the second one in theaters. And neither my girlfriend at the time or myself had seen the first one. So we didn't really know what this was all about. We just figured, let's just go and hang out with Howie and his wife, and we'll go have dinner, and it'll be a whole thing, and let's not worry about it. And now that's normally uncharacteristic of me, because I have to, if I'm going to see a sequel, I have to see the first one first, you know?
Yeah.
I have to know what's going on. So normally that's how I do things. In this case, I just let the fucking moment take over, and let's just go and have some fun. I know Sylvester Stallone's in it. A whole bunch of dudes are in it. It'll probably be just a bunch of explosions. It'll be cool. I'll be fine. So we went to it and we saw it, and I thought it was pretty good. And it was exactly how we just described Snake Eyes. Just fun, just over the top, you know, action. And that's all it was meant to be. Entertaining. It was entertaining. And my then girlfriend, she was like, not into it at all. She thought it was ridiculous. And I was like, look, not every movie has to be an Oscar film. You know, mm-hmm. This doesn't have to be Rain Man. You know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
it's like, you know, she's like, oh, all these, it was so over the top. None of that could have ever really happened. I'm like, yeah, I know, but it's entertainment.
That's
you know,
the point.
Like,
that's and the it's point funny of that, those films, I, you know? Like,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I wanted to give you the opportunity. I know we were kind of talking back and forth. I want to chat with you kind of about this, this track, this, what is mm-hmm. it? Norcos. I cannot enunciate this. But I want to talk to you about that project. But first, you mm-hmm. also mentioned that there's, you've got like a ton of Putz related news.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I kind of
yeah.
wanted to give you a little bit of a platform. If you kind of want to
yeah.
Brush over this, just tell me a little bit about either what we can expect in 2022. You know, just what's yeah. coming down the pipe for the Putz.
Well, we've been, I just checked with Billy, earlier today to make sure I had this right. Since the pandemic has started, the Putz have recorded 36 songs in the studio.
Jesus Christ.
And yeah, we've made about 4 or 5 separate long weekend trips to the studio scattered out throughout the pandemic. And usually we'll go for like between two and four days at a time. And so, you know, we've got about four or five long weekends under our belt since the pandemic started. So we're sitting on a bunch of stuff. We've got a track. Let me see. We did 3 tracks. I'm not going to talk much about it right now, but 3 tracks that are going towards a really fun split record that is going to come out on Mom's Basement Records.
Oh yeah.
That I think they're going to, I think I'm going to let John announce more about that. It's a split with another band, very exciting split, three songs each. And I'm going to let him announce more about that. Probably over the next couple months, we'll probably hear about that. Then we've got five songs that we recorded that go, that are going to go on a an EP. We don't really have a name for it yet, but we're kind of like tentatively calling it Crazy Christmas Party because it's kind of like Mad Monster Party, yeah, but it's a Christmas version. Yeah, so it's a Christmas version of Mad Monster Party. And, you know, I understand the Christmas thing is starting to get a little played out. That Jagger Holly Christmas album was really good, and there's been a couple Christmas comps that have come out. So I get it. You know, maybe at some point people are going to be, like, done with the Christmas records, but we're kind of hoping we can get this one out before that happens. Where people are like kind of like whatever about it. Because this one I think is really fun. And it's five songs. It'll be probably a very similar release as Mad Monster Party was. You know, like a one-sided 12-inch where it's, we might have an etching on the other side, just like we did with Mad Monster Party. Probably put out, you know, the same, press the same number of them, probably on a couple different colors, just like we did with Mad Monster Party. So it's basically, you know, you can consider it almost like in a set. The two of them.
That's cool.
Whatever you want to call it. Yeah. So we recorded that. We got five of those tracks for that. And then let me see what else. We've got a track for Zach Buzzkill's label. You know, Zach from the Radio Buzzkills.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I interviewed him season two. Great human being.
Yeah. He's funny. He's really funny. Mm-hmm. Very smart guy. He's putting out a comp. I don't think it's out yet, although sometimes I hear about it a little bit after everybody else does. Whenever he has new updates on this comp project, I always seem to be a few days behind on it. But it's a comp project with 101 bands on it that are all playing like 30-second songs or less.
And, I've seen stuff about that. It's like a 101 or something, punk rock 101 or some
punk
shit like
rock
that.
101 or, yeah, exactly. So we have a song on that we recorded during the pandemic. We have a song on that. He's already got it. As far as I understand that project's pretty far along. I'm pretty sure he's just about ready to put it out any day now. So that should hopefully come out soon. So we have a song on that. And then there is a project in the works for a Queers tribute, kind of like the previous tribute album. What was that called?
Joe played us a song or something like that.
No. There was another one, God Save the Queers or something like that.
Yeah, it's got the green monster on the cover of it or whatever.
Yeah. This one's intended to be a follow-up to that. And it's basically just like that. It's just like your favorite bands covering the Queers, real simple. You know, cool. It's a tribute album. And it's like a volume two. It's going to be like literally a volume two of that. And that's being put together right now. I don't know about a whole lot that's been publicly discussed about it, but we have a song on that, and I'll just leave it at that.
Cool.
We're pretty excited about that one too. And we have, of course, a brand new album recorded. That was the most recent thing we did back in September. And went in, cut about, I don't know, something like 18 or 19 songs. And we're going to cut it down to like, you know, between 14 and 16 songs for the actual album.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked on that in September and early October. And that's still being mixed. That's probably, of all the different projects, that's the least furthest along, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but lots going on. I'm sure I forgot something, but yeah, lots going on.
Well, you mentioned you wanted to premiere a track, which obviously that you know we'll drop that in following you know the editing process, but it's for one of your projects, and please pronounce this properly for me. But it's Norcos y Horchata, is that correct?
Yeah, pretty close. Yeah,
pretty close.
Norcos, it's like Norcos y Horchata.
Okay. You are talking to the whitest upstate New Yorker you know, but the track itself is called Clutter, Debt, and Disarray, and I wanted to pick your brains as to, you know, tell me a little bit about the project. You can kind of give me a 100-foot 100-foot overview, but also why this track in particular, and it could be something as simple as this is what we have ready. I know there was some other stuff in that folder that you shared with me, but I'm wondering you know, tell me a little bit about this track and why it's, you know, why this kind of rose to the top for you.
Well, this, okay, so we've already got another track out there from the same recording session as this one. It's called All Roads Lead Downriver, and it's on a band camp, Norcos y Horchata band camp, and it's the only song we got out there. We put it out back during the summer just to get people kind of, just to give wet their whistle a little bit, you know? And, you know, we look at what else we've got recorded. We've got over a full length's worth of material recorded. We've got about maybe 14 songs total recorded that we worked on during like two or three different, you know, weekend sessions here in Detroit throughout the summer. And, you know, we're looking at what else we're sitting on. We're kind of like, don't really, I mean, this is something you might be able to relate to. You don't really know when the record's going to be out. So how much do you really let out at a time? And exactly, what songs do you leak out? You know, you almost have to be kind of meticulous about it. And we came out strong with All Roads Lead Downriver because that is just, if you get a chance to listen to it, it's on the Bandcamp page. It's just a total anthem. It's just a big, huge group vocal. It's like a total, it's catchy as hell. It's, so we knew coming out straight out of the gate as a brand new band, coming out with something like that was just going to be great. And that was a no-brainer. But then this is the only other song that's been heard publicly, is the one you're going to play on this show. Mm-hmm. That's it. There's no other song, no other, you know, there's one teaser video that our guitar player made that's like 45 seconds of a song, of another song called I almost lost my thumb to the Pinewood Derby. And yeah. And there, that, but that's not the entire song. It's just like a 45-minute clip. It's a little fun little teaser video. So technically, the one you're going to play, Clutter, Debt, and Disarray, is only the second full entire song that's been publicly heard, you know, by this band. So I'm excited about that. And we wanted to pick this song because it's a little different than All Roads Lead Downriver, and just wanted to show a little bit of variety. The band's got even more variety. That's why I'm so eager for everybody to hear the album. Hopefully we can get it out by summer. We're working on it. And this song is just straightforward, fun. It's like stripped down. It kind of reminds me of like the Fun Oi, if that makes sense.
Sure,
like,
sure.
Like Cox Bar and stuff like that. It has a little bit of that flavor to it. But then it also has the rough around the edges type influences. We have other influences that are heard pretty frequently throughout all of our songs. Like, you know, we really like bands like FYP and Toys to Kill and The Arrivals from Chicago, and, you know, a little bit of Dillinger Four in there, you know, that kind of thing. We're really into all those types of bands too. So if you take that and mix it with like, say, a Cox Bar or maybe The Business a little bit, but not serious. And you just give it that kind of stern, you know what I mean, when you hear the track. It's like, you know, it's like, but it's fun. And the thing is, I think we really like playing rambunctious, hearty, fast, crude music that doesn't really necessarily have to be about anything serious. I like the contradiction in that. Mm-hmm. I like that you can, I mean, how fun is it to hear a band that's like, you know, heavy and crazy and wild, and they're singing about fucking crap, you know, fun crap. I guess maybe that's probably one of the things that people like about somebody like NoFX or something. You know what I mean?
Sure.
That contradiction. Well, we like that contradiction. So a lot of the songs are like a tongue in cheek take on lessons in life. You know, they say just sing about what you know. Well, Amato, our main songwriter and singer and guitar player, one of my closest friends, and he's in the Devious Ones with me, he, you know, that's what he does. He sings about what he knows, mm-hmm. or what he observes, what he sees around him, you know. Mm-hmm. And you can really see that in the music, like you can really in the lyrics. I mean, you can really, you know, and I know where most of the songs come from because I know him pretty well. I know a lot of his stories, a lot of his experiences. But even the songs I'm not like certain absolutely what inspired this song, I can kind of tell just by knowing him. And the good thing is, I think you don't have to be me. You can be a perfect stranger that's never met Amato before and just hear these songs, you're like, you think you know this guy, you know what I mean? Like, but I like that about him. I like that about songs like that, like real honest storytelling.
That's cool.
You know, real honest storytelling is a good way to put it, I guess.